You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, gas price pain. Uber and Lyft drivers take-home pay plummeting as gas prices soar. Are the ride-sharing companies doing enough to help? Plus, Google and Apple Maps can't escape politics. How mapping technology has become increasingly complicated as Russia rains down on Ukraine. And relief efforts to help millions of Ukrainian refugees and residents who've stayed behind. We're going to talk with Flexport about the challenging logistics of providing humanitarian aid and how the war is roiling global supply chains. Russia's government is moving closer to seizing and even nationalizing foreign-owned companies that are leaving the market over the invasion of Ukraine, while planning measures to coax others into staying. Bloomberg's Creighton Harrison with us now to discuss. So, Creighton, what companies is Russia trying to take control of or even temporary control of, and how would the government actually pull this off?
Yeah, they're not revealing a lot of their plan here about what kinds of things they would want to take over. You can make some guesses based on, there's even been some public comments from officials in Russia that have been walked out by other agencies about some of the aircraft that's in Russia right now that's owned by lessors and whether they might seize some of that. So that's just one example. There's a Russian agency who said, no, we're not going to necessarily do that. That person spoke out of turn. So this is a very confusing time. But at least what the action of the government would allow them to do is it says that if there's a company where you have Russian members of a board, and maybe that's for a local operating unit or something like that, that might be a company that could be taken over. At least on a temporary basis. So this is very, very fuzzy and can be interpreted a lot of different ways. It probably will be interpreted a lot of different ways depending on what happens in the weeks to come. If you're a company that's operating in Russia or was until very recently operating in Russia, I guarantee you looking at this very seriously and trying to figure out what it means for you. But all the companies we've tried to reach out about this, including Larry Culp, the CEO of General Electric, who was on Bloomberg Television a little earlier today, are so far saying they don't see any immediate concern of any asset seizures. So this is something that's going to play out for a while.
At this stage, and of course we just reported on Goldman already moving employees out of the country, what can companies do to avoid this fate?
Yeah, I mean, as we've seen all week, you know, companies have been very careful in their language about what they're doing when they stop doing business in Russia. You see the word suspended or paused quite a bit. In many cases, McDonald's was a very prominent example of this. Companies are continuing to pay employees at the local level. You can think of that as one potential strategy here to avoid getting nationalized or having assets seized, because you can argue that you're still in the country, you're still paying Russian employees, you're still there as a business entity, you're just not actually, you know, doing business at the moment, but you plan to eventually. So that may be one tack the companies are trying to take to protect their long-term interests here. Ultimately, though, you know, if you have money in the Russian economy that you can use to pay workers, at some point you got to figure out how to replenish that. That could run out at some point. So depending on how long this situation takes to unfold, you know, you could have a situation where companies that were trying to hang on by paying employees might have to make another decision.
All right. Question again, what does this mean for everyday people in Russia? Bloomberg's Creighton Harrison, thank you for that context. Meantime, everyone feeling the pain at the pump, especially drivers for Uber and Lyft, as the war in Ukraine drives gas prices in the U.S. to an all-time high. Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos has the story. Jackie, in California, I saw prices as high as $7. I mean, unprecedented. How are drivers dealing with this?
Well, this is truly taking a huge cut out of their take-home pay, and the impact has really been indiscriminate. We saw drivers that are driving fuel-efficient cars, a Prius even, that are seeing their gas bill go from 10% to 60% of their net earnings. This is just completely unprecedented, and it's really making them reevaluate, is this side hustle even worth it?
And what are the companies doing about it? Are they doing enough?
What drivers tell me is that it's not enough. You know, they have partnerships with this app, for example, called Get Upside, and it's effectively a rewards app that gives you cash back for your fuel purchases. But drivers tell me that this is really a laughable solution, and it's not sustainable. As you said, gas prices are upwards of $7. You know, one driver spoke with me, and he said he was paying upwards of $5. He's losing money at every ride he takes. He does not have the option to quit the app. But it does beg the question, should companies be on the hook for helping them more, especially because as independent contractors, they're the ones footing the bill for every single expense.
Now, the president himself has said, look, the American people are going to have to be prepared for a certain amount of sacrifice and a certain amount of pain if the United States is going to take this kind of a stand against Russia. In talking to drivers, do they understand, do they sympathize with the Ukrainian people and what the United States is trying to do here?
There definitely is a huge tension there. You know, they completely sympathize. However, they've been putting up with high gas prices and the impacts of inflation for months. It's been acknowledged by, you know, even Uber CEO. It's not the first time that they've raised the alarm about the impact of gas prices. And this just seems to be a real breaking point for so many. And so while I think they understand the broader plight of the Ukrainian people and the complex nature of the conflict, I think at this point they have enough options out there within the gig economy, from DoorDash, Instacart, Lyft. You know, there are other places to go, even outside the gig economy as well. So it's something they're considering.
And what does it mean for consumers and riders? Are prices going to go up?
You know, we've already seen high fares for a while due to the driver shortage and gas prices. What Uber had to say, for example, is that for every 20% increase from today's average gas price levels, consumers will only see a 1% increase in fares. Now, that may sound small, but when you take into account how quickly demand is coming back and supply is not shifting as quickly to meet that demand, we're going to see elevated fares for at least a few more months until they're able to sort through that supply issue. And yes, gas prices will eventually start to trickle down to how much we're paying in fares overall as well.
All right, Jackie Davalos, who covers Uber and Lyft for us. Thanks, Jackie, for that update. Coming up, Apple and Google Maps in the crosshairs of the war on Ukraine, how space, satellite, and big tech companies are navigating geopolitical turmoil. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Soon after Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, Google and Apple disabled key features of their map services there, including real-time vehicle and foot traffic data. This out of concern that live insights into what streets or shops were busy could be exploited by Russian forces to harm Ukrainian citizens. In fact, the nuances of mapping has become significantly more of a political hot potato in just the last 2 weeks. I want to talk about that and more with Chad Anderson, founder and managing partner of Space Capital, an early-stage venture capital firm that invests exclusively in space-based technologies. And Chad, many of these space-based technologies are delivering information to these big tech giants that enable them to change these digital maps in real time. What do you make of this new, if you will, digital battlefield?
It's certainly true. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has really spotlighted the strategic importance of space infrastructure for the U.S. and our allied satellite constellations. Space is clearly a target, and among the critical domains to protect as this conflict unfolds. You know, with the Google Maps and Apple Maps scenario, this is some of the first information that we got about the Russian invasion came about because of the traffic information from Google Maps. So, you know, these companies have decided to turn off that functionality. They're still getting turn-by-turn directions, but they've turned off the traffic and foot traffic functionality because it can alert the other side as to where Ukrainians are, and as well, it goes both ways. But they've decided to turn it off to protect those citizens in Ukraine.
Well, and at what point does that potentially undermine Ukrainian efforts to resist the invasion or flee to safety? I mean, have we outsourced too much power to big tech?
Well, they've turned it off from a global perspective. I'm not privy to who they've turned it on and off for. So I imagine that companies have this type of functionality and capability.
So let's talk about the space companies that are getting dragged into this mess, these satellite technology companies that, you know, have been floating around relatively quiet outside of the Earth's atmosphere, but suddenly find themselves in the middle of this geopolitical mess.
Yeah, I mean, this crisis has really highlighted the growing capabilities of commercial satellite companies. Companies like Maxar and Planet and BlackSky are providing observations of what's happening on the ground. So we're getting really ground truth. And this is vital information for anyone trying to keep up from a humanitarian perspective or monitoring the situation, military, civilian. This is giving us, you know, without the spin, we're able to see with our own eyes what's actually happening on the ground. And I think that the amount of data that's available today is really unprecedented. This open source information is really important for everyone involved, including the reporters that are on the ground looking to tie the pieces of the story together.
We also saw Elon Musk's Starlink very publicly jump to the aid of the Ukrainian people, and it just sort of drives the point home about how powerful and impactful these technologies can be in terms of just changing the shape of modern communication. You know, what kind of risks do these companies face, and how are they navigating these challenges internally?
Certainly. I mean, SpaceX turned Starlink on, their satellite communications constellation, made it available in the Ukraine upon request. And it's really showcasing, you know, what a capability like this can provide in terms of redundancy and capability. I mean, they're providing vital communication services where in a previous era, the invading country could just attack the fiber lines and or attack in some other way and shut off the internet. So we really have resilient communications and connectivity here, which is also essential in terms of getting vital fact, truth, you know, like from the source information. And we talk about a lot about this in our latest thesis paper, the SATCOM Playbook. The nature of satellite communications is going through a fundamental shift. I mean, it's going from being a niche comms product, making up about less than 1% of global broadband internet, to being a internet backbone in space, where we could see 20 times the capacity come online in the next 5 years at latency that rivals terrestrial. And there's not much that Russia can do about it from a practical perspective. Elon Musk has said that they can shake their fist at the sky. You know, Russia's trying to jam those signals now, but SpaceX is able to overcome that with a simple software update. So, you know, cybersecurity is also a key area here for companies and military as well.
It's really a fascinating domain, given that a lot of these companies are often fielding requests from governments to draw the maps a certain way, then sometimes showing different maps in different countries. And you wonder how they can, you know, overcome some of the transparency or lack of transparency issues there. Chad Anderson, founder and managing partner of Space Capital, thank you for helping us work through that. Now for our crypto report, with Bitcoin dropping back below $40,000 and erasing nearly all gains from the optimism surrounding President Biden's executive order on crypto, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are now falling, with stocks amid high inflation data, continued geopolitical turmoil as we continue to watch this situation in Ukraine. I want to get more on this and the future of their new crypto fund with Michelle Baye, partner at Sequoia Capital, which recently launched such a new fund. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. Of course, Sequoia is not new to crypto investing, but this is the first time you've launched a sector-specific fund. Why and why now?
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Emily. It's great to be here. We've been investing in crypto for several years, over 5 years now, and in getting feedback from our founders about the best products to serve them, realized that we served equity-based crypto companies very well with our seed, venture, and growth products, all the way from seed to IPO, but that we could do more for token-based crypto companies. And so this new fund is allowing us to take a more active management role with our liquid tokens, and it'll complement our broader efforts. And we thought this was a great time because it was, you know, driven by feedback from our founders, but also because crypto is at such an inflection point in terms of both users and talent entering the space. We think we're just at the beginning of an S-curve that we'll see pick up dramatically over the next decade.
Now, Sequoia has invested in Bitcoin and Ethereum itself, for example, but also in companies like FTX. When it comes to the token side, what are tokens and blockchains that you find particularly interesting?
It's a great question. I think we watch the developer momentum on each layer one blockchain and several of the layer twos very closely. That's an important signal for us. And so Bitcoin has a particular type of community and a particular use case. You see some things being built out with a Lightning network that one of the companies we are privileged to partner with, Square, now Block, is very involved with, as well as then on Ethereum, tremendous applications, development in decentralized finance, NFTs, web applications. And then we've also seen a lot of developer uptick on Solana and some newer chains like Avalanche, Near, Cosmos. And so we watch all of that very closely, and that's how we determine where we want to, you know, double down or spend our time in terms of those different ecosystems.
Now, last year, 20% of Sequoia's new investments in, as I understand it, the U.S. and Europe were in crypto. That's a really big part of the pie for a long-time, more traditional tech venture capital firm. Do you see that portion of the pie rising into 2022? Is this going to become an even bigger part of Sequoia's portfolio?
I personally do. As someone who spends all my time in crypto, I think there are just tremendously talented founders entering the space, and more engineers, developers, designers who are excited about building in all aspects of crypto. And so I think that will only increase over time. We at Sequoia have a thesis that crypto is going to impact both the financial sector as well as broader internet services. So that's consumer and enterprise. And so we expect crypto to eventually be in all of those sectors. And I would expect that everyone at Sequoia is eventually a crypto investor.
You've talked about how this is going to be very different from traditional venture capital investing. Tell us a little bit more about the fund structure. How are your investments in crypto and the cryptocurrency industry going to be different than what we've seen Sequoia do before?
Yes. So what's interesting about investing in more traditional equity-based startups is that you effectively get a piece of paper that says you own a portion of a company, and you don't really do much with that piece of paper over the next several years. You help the company grow, of course, but the piece of paper is sort of irrelevant. In crypto, it's quite different in that if you are getting a token, you can actually use that token to the benefit of the company or the project. And so what we can do now more flexibly is be able to, for instance, stake our tokens to help secure a proof of stake network. We could provide liquidity to protocols and just do a lot more activity with our tokens than you would with an equity.
So obviously we've seen a ton of activity in the crypto space. We've seen the power of crypto to be used to support war efforts in the Ukraine, for example. There's concern about crypto being used by Russians who should be facing sanctions to circumvent those sanctions. What's your take on how the war on Ukraine is impacting the crypto space and where this is headed?
Yeah, well, first, I mean, we are all heartbroken by what we're watching. It certainly hits very close to home. Sequoia has Ukrainians who have Ukrainian family. We have companies who have, you know, employees in Ukraine, and of course many users. And so it's something that we watch every day, and our heart goes out to all of them, and we do all that we can. We're really proud of the way that our crypto and other companies have stepped up to support all the efforts. So I work very closely with Sam and the team at FTX. They've gone above and beyond to both donate to Ukrainian users on the platform as well as comply with all sanctions, which they're very capable of doing. It's often a misnomer that, you know, crypto companies can't. They can certainly comply with sanctions, and all the companies we work with will. And then there are other companies. Airbnb has been, you know, offering housing, and so folks are doing everything that they can to support Ukraine and comply with all of the efforts for sanctions.
And do you look at cryptocurrency as a safe haven or a safer asset than a traditional equity in this moment? I mean, we saw some optimism around at least the way Bitcoin was trading. We've seen that be wiped away. We've seen a lot of volatility. You know, how should we make sense of cryptocurrency as an asset? How is Sequoia making sense of cryptocurrency as an asset?
I think we're in this interesting moment where all of crypto gets painted by many investors with a broad brush, when as the world more comes to understand crypto, we'll see that assets are quite different. And so the volatility that you see with Bitcoin or what you're buying with Bitcoin is very different than what you're buying with an application token or any other type of, you know, crypto asset, whether it's an NFT, et cetera. And so I think you can certainly look at the volatility and you can say, you know, is Bitcoin trading more like an equity? Is it trading more like a commodity? How should it trade? But the truth is that we're just very early in the world understanding Bitcoin and broader cryptocurrencies. And I think the way those assets trade over time will change a lot.
All right. Michelle Baye, partner at Sequoia Capital. Thank you. Fascinating. We'll be watching the moves Sequoia makes in this space. Well, Stripe is announcing they're launching payment support for crypto businesses, including exchange wallets and NFT marketplaces. They'll also be partnering with FTX and FTX US to improve Stripe's Know Your Customer protocols. We had a chat about crypto with Stripe President John Collison a few months back. Take a listen to what he had to say.
One thing we're really hung up on is 22% of commerce today is cross-border. That's it. Like, it feels like it should be much higher, especially on the internet, where it's so easy to have cross-border interactions. And so crypto is one very exciting direction for trying to solve that.
Coming up, we're going to talk about Web3, mixed reality, and the metaverse. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. Get ready for the launch of Magic Leap 2. The company has raised $500 million in funding, shifted its focus to enterprise customers. I want to talk more about that journey with Peggy Johnson, the CEO of Magic Leap. Peggy, thank you so much for joining us. So we're looking at the latest iteration and improvements on ML1. What are some key changes you're making with the latest version of the technology?
Well, thanks for having me back, Emily. And the latest version is 100% focused on enterprise. In fact, it's purpose-built for enterprise. And what we heard that folks in the areas of healthcare, defense, and manufacturing needed were a bigger field of view. So we've doubled that field of view. That's the area that you can place the digital content within. We've also improved the optics from one end to the other. There's better text legibility. The image is crisper and clearer. So we've done a lot to focus on the improvements that were needed to meet the specific use cases in those three areas.
So what is the market opportunity here? Who do you see using this?
Well, IDC says the market opportunity in enterprise AR is $39 billion by 2025. But the real near-term opportunity is in those three areas. So, for instance, in healthcare, we are making the device able to take into the operating room, and doctors can now wear it during surgery because they can still see the patient in front of them, but they can hang a variety of screens around them to check the patient's vitals. We've also changed the orientation of the field of view to be more up and down, so they don't have as much body movement. They can just glance up, see the vitals, and look back down at the patient. In defense, we have a variety of use cases, largely around training and command and control scenarios. And then in manufacturing, frontline workers gives them the ability really to be hands-free and continue to do their job, but to have digital content put in front of their eyes that can help them do their job better.
Meta's Oculus headset is obviously the market leader for VR right now, though still the market is small. You have Microsoft's HoloLens in AR. Where do you see Magic Leap's headset competing and how?
Well, I see us as the leader in the fully immersive AR sector. So some of the other devices in AR might be just meeting a narrow enterprise use case. with all of the new improvements in our device, we can meet a much broader set of use cases. And so you can think of us sort of as the higher end, where you need more accurate placement of that digital content in your physical world. And those are the requirements of the three markets we're focused on.
The device looks like a blend of AR and VR. You know, why do you think mixed reality is the way forward? I've spoken to some folks lately who think it's all about AR, and that, you know, most consumers and employees, if you're using this through your business, don't want to be stuck in a virtual world.
You're right, and I think the real promise of the metaverse is in augmented reality. We want to have our heads back up again and seeing our physical world and just having that content intelligently placed into that world. And so we are focused on AR, but we did introduce an interesting new innovation called dimming, where you can take the light out of what you're seeing and you can have almost like a super focus on something. So doctors can take the light out of a bright operating room and just see the knee in front of them that they're operating on. And we can do that globally, or we can do it in just segments in front of the screen. Super complex to do because AR is all about introducing light in front of your eyes and we're actually removing it.
So do you think the metaverse is overhyped?
Well, I think we're at the beginning of a technology, and I think oftentimes new technologies do get a bit of a hype cycle. We are staying very grounded in what the technology is capable of doing today. Over time, I think you'll see the further expansion into consumer AR, but the device is going to have to be smaller, lighter, more of a glasses format. We've made steps toward that with Magic Leap 2. It's about 20% less weight and about half the volume of Magic Leap 1, but it's going to need another turn or two for consumers.
Okay. Peggy Johnson, CEO of Magic Leap, thanks you for stopping by. With the Russian invasion of Ukraine escalating, so is the flood of refugees to neighboring countries, most of them women and children. Bloomberg's Tom McKenzie is on the ground at the Poland-Ukraine border.
We are on the Polish-Ukrainian border, a place called Medyka, where the number of refugees continues to rise. The United Nations saying 1.2 million people have crossed over from Ukraine into Poland just in the last 3 weeks alone. We are now 3 weeks into this war, and the needs of these people are very acute indeed, in temperatures that are well below zero, freezing temperatures and difficult conditions. At the top level, we are getting and hearing of more funding. The United States, the House of Representatives, as they're signing off on about $13.5 billion worth of funding. Part of that will go towards the humanitarian crisis on the ground here. The IMF pushing through emergency funding of $1.4 billion, and the Europeans as well. Ukrainian officials saying they expect to see the first tranche of EU money coming through as early as next week. But this is a reminder, the numbers and the human toll of that need for spending for people whose lives now are very much uncertain and the prospects are very much unknown for what is largely a population of women, children, and the elderly. On the Polish-Ukrainian border, for Bloomberg, I'm Tom McKenzie.
Thank you, Tom. And with Ukrainians taking refuge in Poland, along with Moldova, Romania, and other neighboring countries, this all adds logistical challenges on top of the devastating humanitarian crisis. The logistics company Flexport is lending its expertise to relief efforts and chartering cargo and passenger planes to and from Ukraine. I want to bring in Flexport CEO Ryan Peterson for more. So Ryan, talk to us a little bit more about what exactly Flexport is doing here and the logistical challenges that you're navigating.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on. It's a really terrible situation. So Flexport.org is our impact arm. And what we've done is partner with the United Nations Logistics Cluster, who's organizing, sort of coordinating the overall refugee sites to provide relief goods, medical care, shelter, and other things that are needed to help these people. So they're on the ground, and we're partnering then with UNICEF and a handful of other really established aid organizations to help fulfill almost the wish list of these refugee sites of what are the products they actually need. And then also tapping into corporates and companies that we ship for to get products flowing from wherever they are in the world. A lot of it's coming from the US because That's where Flexport is headquartered, but much cheaper if we can find the things in Europe and bring them by truck across domestic trucking within the European Union. So we've been bringing these goods to Poland, Romania, Slovakia so far. It's kind of a drop in the bucket, but we're getting started. We've raised over $15 million from donors to help us pay for all these flights and get the, and all the transportation to get the goods flowing.
What's been the hardest part of getting aid to the places where it's needed most?
Historically, it's a coordination problem as much as anything. So over the last few decades, over 60% of all the goods that are donated or delivered to humanitarian disaster sites, natural disaster or conflicts like this, over 60% of the goods end up in the landfill eventually. Sort of wrong products, wrong goods sent to the wrong place at the wrong time. Nobody there to receive the cargo. So it's a complex coordination problem. This is something that Flexport's uniquely good at. So we started this in 2017 following the Syrian civil war and in the midst of the Syrian civil war to support refugees in Turkey and in Jordan. And working backwards from those sites, from those refugee camps of exactly what do they need? What are the great people on the ground doing distribution and needs assessment say, here are the products we need and we're ready, raise our hand, ready to receive them, and then partner with great aid agencies and nonprofits and for-profits around the world who have those products so we can coordinate delivery and make sure the goods don't go to waste. And two, make sure there's not chaos. Like if a truckload of stuff arrives and no one knows what's in there and no one's expecting it, it can actually slow things down at these sites. And one of the big problems is too much stuff is donated that's not the right stuff at the right place at the right time. So that's what we're trying to solve for.
Now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has already disrupted the global supply chain. Add to that the sanctions, the impact on Russian oil. What shocks are you seeing in the supply chain, and what are the reverberations you're expecting?
And we've been through, now a couple of years of supply chain shocks, and we do have a very resilient economy, a resilient logistics infrastructure, but you sort of keep pushing the line and testing it, and it's resilient until it's not. So big things right now are we've lost the ability as an aviation air cargo industry can't fly over Russia anymore. Got to go around. That means extra stops, delays, and higher fuel costs. Of course, Russia is one of the biggest providers of energy to the world, including fuel for aviation. And that, so fuel prices are going to go through the roof and raise prices both for air and ocean freight and all forms of trade, trade and freight runs on this energy. But the thing that has me worried the most is actually the loss of grain. Russia is the number one exporter of grain in the world. Ukraine is number five. And if this grain doesn't reach the market, and it looks like Ukraine's probably not going to plant grain this season, that's going to drive huge problems for any food importing nation, as well as fertilizer. Belarus is a major exporter of fertilizer. You're going to lose that. So African countries, many developing nations, Central Asia, Middle East, depend on these inputs and on this food for their population. It can get really scary if that doesn't arrive.
Surely that's going to impact supply and prices. Mila Kunis, who was born in Ukraine, and Ashton Kutcher, I know they're directing portions of a GoFundMe they set up to support Flexport along with Airbnb. FTX's CEO has been involved. I'm curious how much he's donated and how much crypto donations in general have contributed to your overall pie.
Yeah, so we're really pleased to have partners, great corporate partners. FTX has made a big, meaningful donation, over $400,000 from the company so far. And then they're setting up to promote the ability for all their users to provide donations via crypto to the GoFundMe that Mila and Ashton set up for the cause. I don't have the exact stats for how much that's come in, but it's just getting started. It took a little while to wire these things together on such a short notice to get crypto set up with all the regulations that go into that. But that's happening right now, so really proud of that. And also Shopify, who's a major Flexport investor, made a big, meaningful contribution donation to the cause as well. So really, really, really excited to work with such great people.
All right. Well, we're going to continue to monitor your efforts. Thanks, Ryan, for taking the time to explain that to us and for the work that you're doing there to get those supplies that are desperately needed to the people who need them most. Flexport CEO Ryan Peterson, thank you. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. That's all for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow.